I am so happy to be here today. Some of you have got my mic on, everything okay? Thanks. Some of you might have observed my 3-year-old daughter who is with me. So you guys, this is the first time I've shared, and she has been here for it. She's very. Am I doing? I don't know if I'm doing something with my mic wrong. What'd you say? Okay, I feel a little echoey, maybe.
Yeah, that's a little hot.
Okay. Yeah, I have a louder. I project. It's debatable how sometimes I don't need a microphone. But anyways, so she's here with me, and it's been an exciting experience. Yeah, like Rick said, back in Bangkok, my wife and my baby, who just turned one. And as Rick said, the timing was my sister's wedding. I tried to pitch my wife on taking care of two little ones on a 24-hour flight across the Atlantic, get to stay with my parents for a month. And she said she just would like to stay in Bangkok for the time. let me spend it. She said, if you take Emmy with you, you can go stay there for a month. You guys can rest assured she isn't suffering too much. We talk once or twice a day, and she says that the house is cleaner since me and my 3-year-old have left. So I don't know why. I think maybe she's just working a lot harder cleaning since we're gone. But it's been good, and it's been, this has been, like I said, this is the first time I've gone this far with my little girl, and it's been a little bit less of a partnership connection trip, and more of a daddy-daughter adventure. She's gotten to be a flower girl at my sister's wedding. She's experienced Chick-fil-A for the first time. We don't have that. We have McDonald's and Burger King and pizza and stuff, but no Chick-fil-A. So we've in New York either. But do you guys ever go to the airport just to get the Chick-fil-A? Oh, okay. But you guys might not have Chick-fil-A, but you guys have given her another experience. This is the first time in her memory that she experienced it. And that's what we are calling cold weather. And she actually fully embraces it. She argues, she really tries to, she's wearing a t-shirt today. I try to get sweaters on her, but she's, I like the cold weather. I'm like, all right, your choice. If you want to be cold, kid, I'm not going to make you put a sweater on. So we, as Rick said, this is the only church that Emmy and I are coming to. But the reason for that is because you guys have made us feel so loved and cared for. We feel when we come here, we're feeling like we're coming here as family. I knew that this is somewhere that I could come with my little girl, and it would be a welcoming environment where you guys are flexible. And so I really, really appreciate that. And so Rick asked me to share today from my heart. And what I'm going to share, part of what I'm going to share today is something that I've been praying about for years, and it's something that's been developing kind of in our time. And I feel like this is a really good time, and it's time for me to share this for the first time. So a little bit of background. In Bangkok, our work is with local churches, and it's almost all with Pakistani Christians. And so we enable local churches in Bangkok to care for Christians. And what makes Bangkok so hard for Pakistani Christians is the refugee law there. And Thailand, they give no rights to refugees. So in the U.S., if you're recognized as a refugee, we give you certain protections, certain rights. But in Thailand, there are no rights. And so they actively are hunting down Pakistani Christians and other refugees and putting them in a modern day concentration camp, which is called the Immigration Detention Center, and but for short, I just call it the IDC. On this journey, with Life Raft and with helping local churches started about 8 years ago, and at the time, and this is something kind of that this is what specifically has been challenging and interesting for me, is at the time, refugees and helping refugees was an important part of what we did. Because Pakistani Christians are refugees, and the reason that it's so hard for Pakistani Christians in Thailand is because of how the Thai government treats refugees. And at the time, you know, using the word refugee, when I used that word in any audience, almost the word refugee, it immediately kind of sparked this idea of, oh, like this person needs our help. It was this kind of instinctive like compassion of, we want to help this person. But kind of as the years go by, I've been challenged in how I talk about this and in terms of how people can receive it. Because what I've noticed is that after the Syrian war, as ISIS was linked to refugee conflicts, the word refugee has started to take on kind of a connotation of, it's not just necessarily these are people who need help, but there's also these are people who might be a threat to us. And this has been a challenge, you know, and this is relevant to America. So, you know, in Thailand, you know, America does recognize rights of refugees and will provide shelter. If Pakistani Christians or other persecuted Christians came to America, our laws would give them protection. But like some of the, you know, in Thailand, you know, the real challenging things are the fact that there are detention centers, the fact that there's family separation, and those things are happening here now too. And so I'm challenged, and okay, like how do I respond? How do I think about this? And two for me, because I come from a more conservative background, and so I believe in laws, I believe in borders, I believe in fairly applying laws. And one of the interesting things about this for me, kind of, and I'm a thinker. The reason I wanted to help refugees. These are people who like elicit compassion. This is why we're able to help, because so many churches, both in Bangkok and here, feel this compassion for persecuted Christians. But for me, the reason I got in wasn't because I'm like an especially compassionate person. I can be kind of hard sometimes. But the reason is because I'm a person who I care about justice and I care about fairly applying the rules. And I started Life Raft because I saw a refugee family at my church, and he was in so much need. And I had compassion, but what drove me and what made me passionate was, it is the right thing to do. If we're Christians, it's the right, just, fair thing to do to help our brother. And so it's that sense of justice, it's that sense of wanting things to be fair and not wanting certain people to be oppressed that really energizes me and drives my role in this work. And so for me, what's been interesting is seeing this the contrast of justice and mercy. And I think one of the vivid ways of seeing this is, and this happens often. So in Bangkok, if you're a family of refugees, and you have five or six of you kind of crammed into a room, kind of about this size of the stage, and that's your life every day. And the fear is the knock at the door. And because that can mean you're about to be arrested. And so in that moment, the immigration officer will have a choice. And the way I think about, and I think I got the sign of approval from Rick about my descriptions of mercy and justice the last service. Okay. I mentioned last service. I'm not a pastor. Sometimes people just assume I'm a pastor in Bangkok. I'm actually a lawyer. Many people would say that's the opposite of being a pastor. So I want to make sure I don't say anything too. I want to make sure I get the theological check marks from people who are more authoritative in this area than I am. But when I think of justice, that I think that that's the fair application of the rules to everybody. So that's saying, okay, this is the rules, and we're going to apply it fairly to everyone. That's justice. And mercy is being spared from what we deserve. So in a lot of ways, it's being spared from justice. And so there's always, and life, and this can go from raising my daughter to how governments make decisions, or is how do I balance mercy and justice? Because we want justice, right? I do. I want fair application of the law, but like we also all know that we need mercy. So for me, and just kind of think, like how do we balance like mercy and justice? And you know, you see at the knock on the door, that's the picture. You have an immigration official. Let's just say he's seeing a Pakistani family. And they came and they had permission. They had legal permission to stay in Thailand for probably about 30 days. And they would have done everything in their power to stay in Thailand legally. But the law didn't allow that. And so rather than go back to Pakistan, they chose to stay against violating the law. And so in that moment, that immigration official, as either the family opens the door or as they break the door down, that immigration official has the choice of justice. Do I apply this law fairly to this family, or do I show mercy? And is not always an automatic answer. And so in terms of my role and how I think about this and how I think about what Life Raft and what churches in Bangkok and even like how Christians should try to balance this, was really impacted by a conversation I had this past year with a British person who's been living in Bangkok for probably over 20 years now. He's there with his wife. And he has retired, but he has been regularly visiting prisons in town. So this isn't the IDC where people are held just because of the immigration, because of overstaying their visa. This is prison where people go because they might have murdered someone, they might have stole something, drug-related crimes. And so he's visiting, you know, bona fide criminals. And one of the interesting things is a little bit of a side note, but for every international person who goes to prison, they go to prison and they serve their sentence in Thailand. But then before they leave the country, they have to go to the IDC. So they could go to the IDC and then they're hopefully able to go back. And Thai prisons, I don't know if you guys have, like, Thai prisons are kind of famously a horrible, terrifying place to stay. But he says when he goes and meets with these prisoners, they're all the reputation is that the IDC is way worse than the Thai prison. So these guys in prison are afraid to go to the IDC because of how bad the IDC is. And so I was talking to him and kind of asking him about how he viewed his work and what kind of colored his, like how he chose to minister to people. And he shared with me a verse in James 2. And hold on, let me open my Bible. My Bible's slow to open right now. Just give it a second. And it's James 2. And I would encourage you guys just to get, this is like a powerful context. And these, the words, this is a really challenging, good, rich passage from James. So I would encourage you guys to read the whole passage. But I'm going to read 12 through 13 was specifically what he referenced, and it's the end that just was really is profound for me, and it's just I've meditated and prayed on this for a long time, and so in verse 12, I'll use the King James, but feel free to use what so speak ye and so do, as they shall be judged by the as one as you I'm gonna hold on you know what I said I was gonna use King James but that's just I'm gonna. I'm going to use something a little bit more straightforward. Okay, so speak and act as you who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. And this is the key right here. And this is so great news. I got great news for everybody. Mercy triumphs over judgment. And so, and I think here we've kind of, and even now when we use the word judge or judgment, that just has like a negative connotation. No one wants to be accused of judging someone. But I think here the word judgment is real similar to the word justice. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about mercy triumphing over justice. And so we need justice. We need laws. But when given the choice, we want to choose mercy. And so how this is applied to my life is, and this can be a little tricky as a lawyer, where we our job is to know the laws and apply them, but I see myself and I move as simply an agent of mercy. And so when I go to the IDC, you know, I'm not criticizing the IDC. I'm not trying to get them to change their laws, but I go there with respect of respecting their role as justice, as people who are bringing justice. You know, similarly, like in my interaction with Thai people, there's a big question in Thailand, just like here, how do we want to treat refugees? What are our laws? And so my attitude kind of with the role as Christian, as a Christian worker, as a Christian helper, isn't your laws are bad or this is wrong, but it's just asking for mercy. That's the role that churches in Thailand are also taking. So it's really important to us that we're respectful of the government, that we respect the laws, but we seek to be agents of mercy. And when I came here last June, and one of the things that I know, because you guys are so connected, and I know I'm just so confident that you guys are praying. You know, not only are you faithful in financially supporting us, but I also know that you're really faithful in prayer for us. And so, and I know starting in June, you guys have been praying, and obviously always. But when I shared, one of the things that I really asked you guys to pray for was for, especially for children and mothers in the IDC, and for mercy, where we prayed for mercy for them. Thinking about the, and one family in particular, I've been close to over the last 2 years or so. And the father's name is, he's in the IDC and he's Hoptom. And so at the time that I came here in June, Hoptom was in the IDC and he was in room 6 with a bunch of other men. And then Hoptom's wife, Osmeret, was in another room in the IDC, and she was there with her 3-year-old son named Yodi and her 1-year-old daughter, who they named Siam because she was born in Thailand, which used to be Siam. Once Hoptom was the person who told me this. I said once he told me that, like, just to kind of give you more of a picture of how hard the IDC is. He said that if he wanted to, you know, back in his home country, he was like actually a professor, so he's really educated. I can speak to him in English. But he said if he wants to go to the bathroom at night, he has to get in 3 fights because the room is so crowded, and you know it's a place where you have to take turn laying down to sleep. Another Pakistani person said, a Christian said that as he was in the IDC, he said, he was having to decide, because the IDC, the conditions in the IDC are designed to be so bad that people will choose to go back to their country where they face persecution rather than stay in modern-day concentration camp. And he said, if I go back to Pakistan, I die once. Here in the IDC, I die every day. And for Hoptom, this is a place where not only is he trying to survive as a man, but his wife and kids are also there in a separate room. I mean, his wife was a really awesome artist. And so at that time, we were trying to make it so that we could visit them every week. But also obviously praying for mercy for this family and for others, that they would be able to get out on bail. Thankfully, about 2 months after that visit, the Thai government did. They opened up bail. And that Christmas, actually, we were able to welcome Osmaret and Siam and Yodi into our house for Christmas. And they made us like some of their own like local food for Christmas. And this is like even like putting a final like really cool part of this story. My wife is a social person, and so actually while Emmy and I are here, she's invited Osmaret and the two kids to stay with us, so she has more companionship and it's a little bit better living environment for them. So it's just been a really cool relationship to build. And but that's as an answer to prayer for mercy. And because not only was Osmaret and her two kids able to get out, but about 30, since October of last year, almost 35 mothers have been able to be released from this detention center and to be in freedom in community. And not only that, but there has been like continued answers to prayer for mercy. So before we would visit Osmaret and Haptam, and we would have two visitors. So one person would visit Osmaret and bring her and her two kids out from their room, and then somebody else would visit Haptam and bring him out. And by doing that, the kids got to see their dad. But now the kids are out, and so for a while, like that meant the fathers just couldn't see their kids hardly at all. They still chose that, like because they wanted their kids out of that horrific environment. But over the past few months, the IDC has opened it up so that visitors are able to bring children inside to see their dads. And it's been, and so the basic rule has been you can bring kids in the IDC. So what I've been able to do is, you know, we make it so, again, almost every week we try to make it so that the Yodi and Siam can see their dad. But the rule is kids can come. So it's been cool for me. I can bring my daughter, Emmy, with me. And so we'll go inside. And, you know, for young kids like Siam and Yodi, who are like 2 and 4 now, they take them around on the other side of the fence so their dad can hug them and play with them. And when we go to the IDC, I'll put Emmy on my shoulders, and so she can kind of like look over the fence. And then on the other side of the fence, she can kind of see her friend Yodi with his dad on the other side of the fence. Just like have that moment of love. And it's like, and she, it's cool for my daughter because she's helping. She's like, yeah, you get to help Yodi see his dad. That's really, yeah, really cool and just like awesome to see that mercy. And thank you guys for praying for that mercy and being an agent of that mercy. That's kind of the update on mercy. I want to share another side of our ministry, which is it's a developing situation. It's how things have changed in Bangkok over the last year or two. One of the interesting things about Bangkok is it kind of gives you a snapshot of the crises in the world. This is before I started Life Raft, but when I just first met refugees in Bangkok, it was actually a Christian from Sri Lanka who was involved in helping an ethnic minority. So it wasn't even Pakistanis who I first met, but it was a Sri Lankan refugee. And since then, that situation has somewhat calmed down, and it was starting in around 2011 when there was in 2012, when there was a huge influx of Pakistani Christians. Those are kind of the predominant, those have been some of the dominant populations. But what's really interesting is when you go to the IDC, there's obviously a large number of Pakistani Christians, but being at the IDC is almost like a picture of all of the conflicts in the world. Any day I go to the IDC, I almost guarantee there will be someone from Afghanistan, from Somalia, from Palestine, from Syria, from Iraq, from Yemen. It's like all these kind of little pieces come to Bangkok, and it shows kind of where the worst places in the world are. Even in the IDC, there's a whole room just for North Koreans. Because Thailand is actually the part of the pathway to go to South. It's not the most direct route, but if you go through North Korea, China, you come down to Thailand, then you can go to South Korea, and so it's a snapshot of kind of some of the worst places in the world, and so most recently, the population in Thailand that has been increasing most have been Christians from Vietnam, and in Vietnam there's different kind of tribes, different ethnic groups, and the ethnic group that has been coming it's called Mothin Yard, and it's French for mountain people, and these are almost like the indigenous people of Vietnam. So this is a smaller group of people that was in Vietnam long before the who would we call Vietnamese people came. So this is a group of people who, you know, have their own culture and even their own language. So most of this people group don't even speak Vietnamese, which is the language of Vietnam. And they also have largely converted to Christianity. So every single Mo Thanh Yard that I've met in Thailand is a Christian, specifically a Protestant Christian, because there's also some, like, Catholicism is in Vietnam. And so that's another strike against them when it comes to their relationship with the communist government of Vietnam. And then third is that they actually fought with America during the Vietnamese War. And so that the government just views them and the fact that they're Christian as a real serious threat to the communist government. And so recently there's been a real significant campaign of ethnic cleansing of this people group. And personally, for me, this has been unplanned but really powerful, because my mom's brother actually fought in the Vietnam War. And he would write letters to back home, and in these letters, he wrote that one of the things that impacted him most was seeing the kids and seeing how this war was impacting the kids. And he wrote of having this really, really deep concern for what the future of Vietnam was, what the future for these kids would be who were being so impacted by this war. And so my mom's brother, he passed away during the Vietnamese War while he was trying to protect his friend in battle. But these people who are coming to Bangkok are those children who he was talking about. And I want to specifically talk about one of them, and the names are a real challenging to get around, but so I'm just going to call him Kepa. And so he fled persecution in Vietnam to Bangkok, and there about a year ago, so we'll go back a year to August of last year. And so he was there with his wife, who was expecting a child. He's there with a group of between 500 and 1,000 other Mo Thanh Yard Christians. And that August, the dreaded knock at the door came. And this was one of the largest raids we've seen in years of refugee communities in Bangkok. And so they took close to 200 of these Christians and put them in jail. And this was really sad, devastating, awful, because they actually, this is for the first time, they actually took all of the children away from the mothers. So even nursing mothers, like, they were losing their supply in prison because their children had been taken from them. For this obviously didn't exactly happen to him, because his wife, he didn't have any kids yet, but his wife was pregnant. And so you can imagine him being in the IDC in this room, which would be, I would say this room, it would be about half the size. The rooms in the IDC, the cages are about half this size, but they put about 200 people in them, up to 200 people in them. And sometimes this room where the Vietnamese are in has gone over 200 people before. And so you can imagine he's in there, and it's a room with people from Cambodia, like all these different countries, and he's in there, and from different parts of Vietnam. If you're in Vietnam, everyone from Vietnam, whether you're a Vietnamese drug lord or a Mo Thanh Yard, like, you're all in this room. And so he's there with about 20 other fathers from this community. And I mean, I don't know exactly what he was praying, but I imagine that he's there and he's praying for mercy for him and for his wife. And praise God, God used the church, and I use the church because this was not an effort of like one person, but it was of so many people, including you guys coming together to help. But the Thai government showed mercy to him, to his wife, and allowed his wife to be released on bail. And so she was able to not give birth in chains, but she was able to give birth in a hospital. The pregnancy had some complications, but she gave birth to a healthy baby boy, local partners in Bangkok are ensuring that, that his wife is cared for. But this whole time, you know, he's seeing God answer his prayers, but he hasn't seen his son. And it's the same for all those. It's about 20 other fathers who are in his from his community who are in this IDC. It's been a year now. So come back to August of this year. It's been a year, and for this entire year, these fathers haven't seen their children. And then one day, again, putting yourselves in this position of he's in his room, and they also not only had they not seen their children, they don't really receive very many visitors. So one day, five of those fathers from that community hear their name called that morning. And that means that someone is coming to visit them. Someone's going to bring them food and other supplies. And so he sees them leave, and you know, he waits. And about 2 hours later, they come back, and they have to have big smiles on their face because someone brought them their kids to see that day. That day, those five fathers got to see their kids. And the next day, seven more fathers from this community, their names are called, and they go out and they come back again, and those seven fathers got to see their kids too. And then about 1 week later, Kepa hears his name called, and he walks out. I think this is the first time he's come out. He's had a visitor, and he comes out, and he sees a stranger holding a baby. And suddenly it dawns on him that baby boy who's about 5 or 6 months old is his son. And so he got to see his son. You can see his tears like filled his eyes, just like he had so much joy to see his son. His baby boy did not have the same reaction. He had left his mother's arms, but changed his mind after about 45 seconds. but the father got to see his son. And I share the story with you. And by the end of that week, every single one of those 20 fathers had the opportunity to see their children. And I share that with you to share the story of mercy, but I also really want to share that with you because it's an example of how of everybody working together. This wasn't just one person who was doing this. God doesn't call any of us. It's really, you know, it's nice to be somebody's hero. It feels really good to be someone's hero, to kind of, it's like you want to kind of save someone, to be a savior. But God doesn't call any one of us to be the hero, to be the savior. He calls us like to work collectively, to work together, to collaborate. And when it doesn't matter who gets the credit, when it doesn't matter who gets the glory, God can use us like you don't even know. And so for this visits that were organized to allow these fathers to see their kids, so Life Earth, like we didn't spend a dime. Like we were involved, and money's required because these mothers are so destitute, like that they can't get to the IDC without someone helping because they live really far away, almost in like the rural, like not even in Bangkok, like outside of Bangkok, and they can't get to the IDC with their kids unless someone allows it. But in terms of who was doing it, the first time it was a trip, it was a group of people from the U.S. and the Philippines, a mission team that kind of came together there, and they were the first people who did it. The second was a local church, a large evangelical church in Bangkok called ECB. They made the second trip happen, both in terms of people and in terms of finances. The third was another Bangkok, a Baptist church in Bangkok, allowed the third visit to happen. And then the fourth was an Australian missions team visiting from Australia that kind of allowed the final trip to let all these dads see their kids. So we helped to, you know, but so their role was, you know, person by person helping providing some finances, providing people. For us, we provide information and guidance. So, hey, listen, like, did you know that you can allow, you can be a person who allows, like, you can help a kid, a dad see his kids? Like, do you want to do that? So we provide just that information and guidance on logistics of how it to happen. So that was our role, but you guys are a part of that too. Cause you guys, like you guys, everybody who's involved, everybody who partners, like makes it possible. And we can't, like you guys are a part of everything we do. And so as you hear these stories, know that you aren't blessed to actually be there and see that, but you are making that happen. And you're making an eternal difference for these refugees. I don't know how long that father is going to be in the United States. So we pray for his release, for him to be able to live in freedom with his family, but it might be, some people there are there for years. There is a Vietnamese, there's a Vietnamese man who's been there for close to 10 years. But I know that for the rest of his life, that father is going to, he's going to be able, he saw his baby, his boy when it was just a baby. He got to see his boy when he was a baby. And so I want to close because I've been sharing a lot about mercy and how we can show mercy. But I think that for us to show mercy in the most profound way is that we do that when we can also receive mercy. And I want to close with, a verse in Luke. So this is Luke 18, and again, encourage you to read the whole passage. But the critical part for me is, and it says, but the tax collector, and this is contrasting with someone who is holy, who prayed a prayer basically thanking God for allowing him to be so holy, for blessing him with holiness. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. And for thousands of years, from the ancient Christian church, the church has been praying this prayer, and they've said it like this. They say, Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy. And I think there can be a value in saying this prayer collectively and in repeating it. And I want us all to close my time with all of us standing up. And all of us just saying this together as a body, and as you say this, I just want you to think to think and to pr- to to re-